It's Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, the list of accusations against Hollywood producer Harvey Weinstein is growing by the day. Our guest says businesses need to do more to prevent sexual assault and harassment in the workplace.
First, the mass shooting last week in Las Vegas has reopened the political debate over gun control. But our next guest says we should also look at gun-related violence as a public health issue.
As an emergency room physician, he says treating gun deaths and injuries as a health issue can help us find ways to prevent future violence and limit the damage when it does happen.
Dr. Stephen Hargarten is professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine and director of the Injury Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin. Dr. Hargarten, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. It was my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, what changes when we think about gun violence as a public health issue? What does that mean?
Well, I think what physicians like myself and others and the nurses and the surgeons that take care of these patients, we reframe this as a biopsychosocial disease. The bio part of it is the gunshot wounds, the fractures, the bleeding organs, the brain damage, and we as physicians and nurses and surgeons bring biology to this event with, in this case, multiple patients. The psychosocial aspects are part of the treatment plans and other things as people survive or the families have to deal with these tragic events. And so if you frame it as a disease, it provides a platform for employing public health tools to prevent the injury event from occurring or lessen the severity if indeed it does occur. It's a useful way to frame these tragic events.
You've compared the lethality of gunshot wounds in some cases to diseases like Ebola. How do they compare?
Well, in a case like the Sikh shooting that I was involved with treating the survivors or the ones that resulted in surviving when we transported to the trauma center, the case fatality ratio of that Sikh event was about 70%. In other words, 70% of the people died and only 30%, three victims, survived. So that's a high case fatality ratio. That's a public health term. And in these mass shootings, the case fatality ratios tend to be very high. And a disease like Ebola has a high fatality ratio. If you get the Ebola virus, chances are very strong that you're going to perish, as opposed to the flu, which has a low case fatality ratio. If you get the flu, you'll get sick, but chances are you won't die.
As you've said, you've treated gunshot wounds as an emergency room physician, both in that horrible Sikh temple shooting and in the day-to-day shootings we hear about. In that emergency room, what are some of the things that are the most challenging about treating, on the physical side of things, the biological side of things, about treating a gunshot wound?
Well, the challenges are is doing things quickly assessing the scope of the injury, assessing the needs for immediate intervention, going to the operating room right away, or inserting chest tubes. So the resuscitation moments that occur as soon as a patient is seen by paramedics and then brought to the trauma center, these are critical minutes that make a difference in the outcome. Once those decisions are made, the patient's in the operating room or the intensive care unit, then expert nursing and care is undertaken to maximize the best outcome. And then if indeed there is a significant injury that results in a disability, spinal cord injury, complex fracture, then the rehabilitation physicians and nurses take over, again, to maximize outcomes. At Freightert, we have a clinical health psychologist who is an expert in managing the psychosocial aspects of this with interventions that help them manage their post-traumatic stress.
We're talking to emergency room physician Dr. Stephen Hargarten with the Medical College of Wisconsin, looking at treating gunshot wounds, gun violence, gun suicide as a public health problem. And Dr. Hargarten, you've talked and written in the past about specific changes you'd like to see to help prevent gun injuries and deaths and to minimize the damage. One thing you've talked about in the past and advocated on is the lethality of different kinds of ammunition for firearms. Can you talk about that?
Well, ammunition ranges from 22 caliber bullets all the way to 50 millimeter bullets for handguns to rifles that have significant mass and velocity, like the one used in Las Vegas. So the higher the mass, the higher the velocity, the greater the extent of injuries. Add hollow point bullets, that's an additional injury level for that kind of a projectile. So projectiles make a huge difference in the predictable outcomes of someone stricken by a bullet.
Right, those hollow point bullets and other kinds of ammunition, I don't fully understand it, but as I understand it, the way they impact and then shatter on contact with a target, human or otherwise, is part of what makes them so damaging and potentially lethal. Is that right?
Well, those ones that shatter are a different type of bullet that fragments upon impact of the victim. Hollow points open up in a predictable way. Some of them do fragment, but others simply open and add additional injury to the victim.
Is it your hope that we have some kind of controls on that kind of ammunition?
Well, I think that the one bullet that we did look at very carefully was a black talon bullet. And in that hollow point bullet, it had razor sharp talons. And we felt that this bullet was inappropriate for the civilian market. It was designed originally for the law enforcement market. And in that case, the black talons represented a hazard, not only to the patient, but also to the surgeons who are quickly trying to find the bleeding source and cut their fingers with the razor-sharp talons and expose themselves to viruses such as HIV and hepatitis. So looking at ammunition, we felt that the black talon was inappropriate for the civilian market.
And when it comes to preventing gun violence, gun injury, and gun death, what kind of changes would you like to see when we look at this again from a public health perspective? What interventions might work?
Well, we've seen that in certain areas around the United States, criminal background checks appear to be an effective way to reduce bad outcomes. Connecticut had strengthen their concealed weapon carrying, their criminal background policies, and that resulted in a decrease in homicides in their state. When Missouri abolished the requirements for a criminal background check for purchasing of a firearm, homicides went up. So it appears, and I think there's a broad acceptance of criminal background checks as a reasonable way to reduce the likelihood that an individual who is not permitted to have access to a gun reduces the likelihood that they're going to get one. It's not perfect, but that's an example. Second is changing the design of guns, where they're designed in a way that only the authorized user can use it. So if it's stolen, it can't be used. If it's taken by a despondent teenager, it can't be used because they're unauthorized, because the gun only permits the authorized user to use it. And that technology is currently present. A German company is manufacturing a personalized gun, and I think that's another hopeful strategy for reducing homicide, suicide, and unintentional firearm deaths.
Do you think we need more research on guns and violence as a public health issue? There's been some controversy about limits on organizations like the CDC in supporting gun research.
Well, if you think about what happened with HIV, think about what was going on in the 80s when people were dying of another biopsychosocial disease. And there was a lot of politics around the early days of HIV and AIDS. And with thoughtful, solid research with appropriate research funding, look what's happened. We are really made major strides in now what has become largely a chronic disease because of all the life-saving drugs that have been discovered through research and other interventions. So we have not had that same investment for related injuries and deaths. And I think we would benefit significantly by having a solid research agenda that looks at all aspects of this significant biopsychosocial disease.
We'll leave it there for now. Dr. Hargarten, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
That was Dr. Stephen Hargarten, emergency physician and professor and chair of the Department of Emergency Medicine and director of the Injury Research Center at the Medical College of Wisconsin.
Coming up, we'll find out what's needed to help victims of sexual harassment at the workplace and prevent future incidents after high-profile allegations involving Harvey Weinstein, Fox News, and Uber. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, lawmakers are holding a hearing today for a bill that would ban so-called sanctuary cities in Wisconsin. We'll get the details.
First, more and more women are coming forward with their stories of sexual harassment and sexual assault after the New York Times and the New Yorker published stories on Hollywood mega producer Harvey Weinstein.
The harassment and assault allegations against Weinstein go back years and involve multiple cash settlements with non-disclosure agreements. They're part of a recent string of high-profile stories of powerful men in business harassing female employees, including companies like Fox News and Uber.
Maya Ragu joins us now. She's Director of Workplace Equity and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center. Maya, thanks for joining us.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Maya, there has been a string of news stories over the past year or two about high-profile men who later face multiple allegations of sexual harassment and abuse. And the stories always seem to detail patterns of behavior that have been going on for a long time, sometimes over the course of years. What can workplaces do differently to prevent sexual harassment and assaults in the first place?
Well, you've definitely hit the nail on the head. I think a lot of the discussion about sexual harassment to this point has been about victims coming forward and reporting and then companies' response to that. But the only way that we're really going to stop sexual harassment from happening in the first place is to think about proactive steps that companies and other employees can take to prevent this from happening in the first place. And that is really going to require investment and commitment and dedication by the leaders of companies to taking on this issue and really changing the culture of their workplace. And it really does start from the top. Employees will take the message and steps to address sexual harassment much more seriously if they see that the leader of the company and leaders of their peer companies are standing up and saying sexual harassment is wrong, and we don't want to just respond to it when it occurs. We want to prevent it from happening in the first place, and here's what we are doing to make that happen.
So you mentioned changing the culture, having leaders be visible and vocal about saying sexual harassment isn't okay. In terms of concrete policies and things that might be more binding, what does changing the culture look like?
Well, first of all, it means having a sexual harassment policy, that's not just a piece of paper, you know, that lives in a binder or on the website or in HR office, but that is meaningful and is implemented through frequent trainings in a way that helps employees understand what it means and how it appears in their workplace and what their responsibilities are to respond to it. So, for example, do managers know about the sexual harassment policy? Do they know what to do in particular situations? Are they held accountable for failing to take action when someone comes forward and reports sexual harassment and conducting an investigation or directing it to the right person? Do employees know what to do in a particular situation? Do they know that they can go and report? Do they feel comfortable doing so? Do they feel like they'll be taken seriously? If coworkers see sexual harassment happening, do they feel empowered to speak up or to act to stop it when they see it? And that's particularly important because although men, of course, can be victims and are victims of sexual harassment, frequently men are the perpetrators of harassment. And when a man sees another man stopping sexual harassment and stepping up to say that's wrong and supporting survivors and victims, that sends a very, very powerful message and can help change culture and behavior. And the other thing that's incredibly important is for companies to send a message that they are that there are consequences for sexual harassment and sexual assault, and that perpetrators will be held accountable. You know, so often what we see, and we see it in these high-profile cases that are reported in the news, is that companies are protecting their superstars or their high performers and trying to brush it under the rug or covering it up. And that allows serial harassers to continue with their behavior with no consequences whatsoever. And that sends really, you know, disturbing and harmful messages. And things aren't going to change unless people in the company, clients, people who interact with the company see that there are real consequences for that behavior, including, you know, losing your job.
If you look at this latest case, the Harvey Weinstein case, as the story evolves, it seems as though now people are saying, well, this went on for, allegedly went on for decades, and this was maybe a secret some people have described as being hidden in plain sight, that there were people who must have enabled this if these allegations are founded. What about the people who surrounded, you were getting at this there, about the culture of enabling or not knowing how to deal with it? What about the people who are not the perpetrator but might be empowered to stop sexual harassment? What do they need? What tools do they need?
Well, again, you're right. This issue of complicity and enabling is a huge issue and goes back to what I was saying before. So they may not feel empowered to act because they may feel there may be consequences for them if they do so. So again, some message from leadership and from the top that encourages people to come forward and say something when they see it and to take action is incredibly important, whether they are, you know, just regular employees or that they're high-level executives, because they are the ones who helped enable and cover up a lot of this behavior. So they need to be held accountable, too, for failing to do something in that situation. And really, that comfort will only come when their leadership tells them that they should be doing this, that they should be putting a stop to it, and they need to be part of the solution.
We're talking to Maya Ragu right now, Director of Workplace Equality and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center, talking about how to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace. And Maya, what's the current state of federal law when it comes to workplace sexual assault and harassment?
So sexual harassment and assault are connected, although they tend to be addressed by two different parts of the law. So sexual harassment is illegal under federal law and under every state's law. It's a form of sex discrimination under Title VII, which is a major federal anti-discrimination law, and many state laws as well. And generally, there are sort of two types of sexual harassment. One is when an employer or supervisor says to someone, you know, have sex with me, go on a date with me, accept these sexual advances in order to get a job or to keep a job or to advance in a job. The other type of sexual harassment is hostile work environment sexual harassment. So that means comments, different types of behavior, groping, unwanted touching, anything that escalates all the way to sexual assault or rape, comments about your body, your sex life, pictures, that rises to a level that's so severe and pervasive that it becomes a hostile work environment. And that's generally the case under state law as well.
Earlier this year, Congress rolled back the Fair Pay and Safe Workplaces order for the Obama administration. How does that change things for women?
Part of what that executive order did was to say to federal contractors that they couldn't require people to go to arbitration to resolve discrimination and sexual harassment complaints. Basically, people were having to give up their day in court. And mandatory arbitration helps cover up things like sexual harassment, because arbitrations are private proceedings that are mostly controlled by employers. They get to pick the arbitrator, they get to pick the forum, the filings, the allegations are kept secret, the ultimate resolution is kept secret, and many of the people who bring the claims need to have to sign non-disclosure agreements once the claim is resolved. So again, you know, that this is happening increasingly, and it's more frequent in employment situations, and it really covers up sexual harassment and can silence victims of sexual harassment. So rolling back that executive order really made it much harder for victims to come forward and seek justice.
The big news this last couple weeks, a couple days, Harvey Weinstein, the company, the Fox company with Roger Ailes. These are high-profile companies with important figureheads, but is this kind of behavior a problem in all kinds of workplaces?
Absolutely. Sexual harassment is a problem in every workplace across the country. We hear about high-profile cases in particular industries more, like media or the tech industry or entertainment, but sexual harassment is incredibly prevalent in a lot of workplaces, and particularly those where you have a lot of people working in low-wage jobs. You know, sexual harassment is about power, and people who are working in certain industries and low-wage jobs, fast food or retail, have a lot less power than someone like Gretchen Carlson or some of the actresses that have come forward. And it is not at all to minimize what happened to them or to minimize their incredible bravery in coming forward and speaking about harassment and violence. But, you know, many times people who are working in these low-wage jobs don't have access to the same resources, so they can't find and hire an attorney, or they can't afford to pursue a lawsuit if that's what they want. And, you know, many of them are supporting families on these jobs. So to come forward is a huge, huge risk. If they lose their jobs, that will endanger their family's economic security as well as their own safety.
Maya, thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That was Maya Raghu, Director of Workplace Equality and Senior Counsel at the National Women's Law Center, talking with us about preventing harassment in the workplace.
Coming up, we'll talk to a political scientist about today's hearing on a state bill that would ban so-called sanctuary cities in Wisconsin. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 8 on The Morning Show, join Kate Archer-Kent and her guests for a look at the top stories in state and national news on this edition of The Week in Review. That's tomorrow morning after 8 here on the Ideas Network.
First, lawmakers held a hearing at the state capitol today for a new bill that would punish so-called sanctuary cities in Wisconsin. A sanctuary city is any city that limits its cooperation with the federal government in its effort to enforce immigration law. While there are gray areas in the definition of sanctuary city, places like Madison and Milwaukee County have limited their cooperation on immigration issues.
As the issue of sanctuary cities is being considered here in Wisconsin, the U.S. Department of Justice gave 5 jurisdictions a final warning about their support of sanctuary policies. The DOJ gave New York, Chicago, New Orleans, Cook County, Illinois, and Philadelphia until October 27th to prove that they're not defying federal law when it comes to immigration enforcement.
Paul Nolette is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University, and he joins us to talk about this bill. Paul, welcome back.
Hi, great to talk with you.
Let's talk about the bill. What exactly would it do?
So a couple of things. I mean, one thing that it does is prevents any jurisdiction from enacting a law or policy that would prohibit the enforcement of any federal or state law dealing with immigration and illegal aliens, illegal immigration. And it would also require localities to go along with what are known as detainers that are issued by federal immigration law enforcement that are essentially our requests to say, hey, we're interested in getting this person for possible deportation. Detain them for an extra period of time so we can get custody of that person. So it would require localities to go along with that, and if they don't, they face possible fines.
Now, a similar bill like this was tried last year. It didn't pass. What does this bill look like in terms of its prospects?
Well, it's a little bit unclear at this point, because if you just look at the numbers, you look at the Assembly where this bill has already passed, and then here in the Senate, Republicans have a solid majority, and in fact, they built on their majority in the 2016 election. You might think this bill might have more possibility of passage this time, but it's still a bit unclear. Even Governor Walker's been a bit noncommittal when he's been pushed on a position on this particular bill, and it's not clear what Senate leadership is going to do to really try to make this bill law.
In terms of sanctuary cities, in the fullest expression of their definition, do we have full-fledged sanctuary cities in Wisconsin?
It's a little hard to say, because sanctuary cities actually have no legal definition themselves. Generally speaking, they refer to any jurisdiction, cities and even states, in fact, that take action to limit their cooperation with federal law enforcement. And so even taking Madison, for example, Madison actually resisted for quite some time being called a sanctuary city, despite the fact that they did have laws on the books that limited cooperation with federal law enforcement. So it really depends on how you define sanctuary cities. But if you take a fairly broad definition and say, hey, any city or state or other jurisdiction that limits in any way its cooperation with federal immigration law enforcement, then there are numerous jurisdictions here in Wisconsin, across the country, that would fall into that definition.
And what reasons do cities typically give for choosing not to fully cooperate with the federal government on this?
I think the big thing is they say that this potentially could have some very disruptive effects among targeted communities. So communities involving that are very much immigrant communities, both legal and undocumented immigrants. And the idea is that, well, one thing that this might do is make it more complicated for police to work with members of that community in, say, solving crimes or getting tips about crimes, because people are going to be too scared to come forward to talk to police if they know that police have these wide-ranging powers that are connected to the federal government and might eventually lead to deportation. So I think that's really one of the key aspects or key defenses of what sanctuary jurisdictions are doing.
Now, a lot has been written about the dairy industry in Wisconsin and how it's, by some measures, a lot of the labor in the dairy industry comes from immigrants. Some of these may be people without papers. Does that something that's come up in this debate?
It has, and in fact, that was part of the hearing today as well. Some concern from the dairy industry, which of course is one of Wisconsin's most important industries, that a huge percentage of workers in the industry are immigrants. And in fact, I've heard numbers around 80% or so, as high as that, being immigrants, either legal or undocumented. So one of the concerns from the dairy industry is if Wisconsin adopts these sorts of laws, it might make it much more difficult for them to fill the many positions that are necessary to have the dairy industry work for the state.
We're talking with Paul Nolet right now from Marquette University about a Wisconsin bill that would penalize so-called sanctuary cities. And Paul, looking at the penalty aspect, what would the penalty be for cities that may not cooperate fully with federal law on immigration?
For cities like Madison and Milwaukee with a large population, it could be up to $5,000 a day, which could be very significant. If that's day after day, you're talking about real money after a period of time. It is scaled depending on the size of the jurisdiction, but certainly I think given that Milwaukee County and Madison are the main targets or what legislators have in mind here, then it's a hefty penalty of $5,000 a day.
Now, we mentioned this hearing going on today, and reporters are saying that there were hundreds of people lined up to oppose this bill. What kinds of stories and commentary has been coming out of this hearing?
I think a lot of it are personal stories about how the discussion over the bill makes individuals in immigrant communities feel like they're a target. And again, this could be those who actually are undocumented, not legal immigrants, but also legal immigrants who think that this is fostering a kind of a culture of racism, specifically against especially Latinos and Latino immigrants. So I think a lot of the stories connected to that sort of thing, saying how their own communities and their own families were affected by the discussions over this bill.
Now, supporters of this proposed bill that would penalize so-called sanctuary cities, supporters say that the bill would make cities and communities safer. What have we heard in that vein?
Yeah, so the other side of the argument essentially says, look, by cooperating with federal law enforcement and having local officials, local police cooperating with federal law enforcement, it can help prevent crimes that might be done by undocumented immigrants. And much like in many other areas of criminal law, federal, state, and local officials often work together to help solve crimes and to help prevent crimes. And so the argument is that this is one step towards getting rid of a barrier that might otherwise prevent the sort of cooperation that could target crimes and target the prevention of crimes.
Paul Nolet stays with us now. He's from Marquette University, and we're talking about a Wisconsin bill that would penalize so-called sanctuary cities.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. What do you think about sanctuary cities, cities that don't cooperate on some level with the federal enforcement of immigration law? How do you think the state of Wisconsin should treat sanctuary cities? Do you agree with this bill, this proposal that would financially penalize cities that don't cooperate with federal enforcement on immigration? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org.
We'll continue our conversation and take your calls in a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrer.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're picking up our discussion now with Paul Nolet of Marquette University about a Wisconsin bill that would punish so-called sanctuary cities here in the state.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you support these sanctuary policies in communities here in Wisconsin? What do you think local governments should do when it comes to cooperating with immigrations and custom enforcement on illegal immigration issues? Should the state penalize local governments that don't cooperate? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll take a caller now. We've got Bill joining us first in Brookfield. Bill, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I can remember the days when Republicans were the party of local control, and the mantra from them was, we should not have state or other organizations impeding upon the rights of cities and communities. Until, of course, the time when Republicans become in control of the state, and then suddenly it's not a matter of local controls and what do cities have as their best interest. They intercede. If you think about the fact that how do cities deal with federal law, which is the nature of this issue, the state really doesn't have any standing in it unless it's a matter of politics.
Bill, thank you for that call and bringing up issues of local and federal control. And I want to ask you to respond to that, but also what power does the Justice Department have when it comes to punishing and setting policy on sanctuary cities?
Yeah, Bill raises an interesting point because certainly Republicans, as he mentioned, even like Paul Ryan, for instance, have long said, oh, it's best to have policies made at the most local part of government, the part of government that's closest to the people. And this may seem to certainly many of the critics of the bill that this is really contradicting that principle. I will say that one thing that is important here, just from a legal perspective and a constitutional perspective, is that it is important to remember that states do have a lot more control over dictating what local jurisdictions can do, like cities, than the federal government does over cities and states. So in other words, what the Wisconsin legislature wants to do and say that Milwaukee or Madison has to adhere to certain things, they do have more power to do that than the federal government does, interestingly enough. So to answer the second part of your question, when you talked about the Department of Justice, actually, cities are on pretty firm ground, I think, strong constitutional arguments that they can make when it comes to the Department of Justice threatening, for example, to pull law enforcement money away from cities or other jurisdictions if they don't comply with federal law. But again, the states typically have more power, including here in Wisconsin, to determine which direction jurisdictions go.
Thank you for that call, Bill. And we're going to go next to Simmer in Milwaukee. Simmer, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. What do you think?
The first thing I want to say, Veronica, is we're going to miss you a lot.
Oh, thank you.
The second is, I know we talk a lot about crime, that the crime is going to be reduced, but do we have data that, being an immigrant myself, I think most of us, my family taught us how to work hard, be a contributing member to the society, but is there truly data that shows that cracking down on illegal immigrants is truly going to reduce crime? Is that, like, somehow I don't buy that.
Simmer, thanks so much for that call. And Paul, is there data that backs up the idea that things would be safer with this sort of legislation?
Well, I suppose, I mean, you can always point to particular crimes, like individual crimes, like, for instance, a murder of a San Franciscan woman that many of the proponents of bills like this one point to say, oh, that crime was done by an illegal immigrant, and so this is what this is trying to prevent. But one thing about the data and crimes is that it actually turns out that immigrants are less likely to commit crimes. There's some logic to this. I mean, if you're an undocumented immigrant, you're worried about getting deported, then in all likelihood, you're going to try to, you know, just do the job that you came across the border to try to do, whether that's in the dairy industry or what have you, and try to avoid bringing attention to yourself. And so for the most part, are there crimes that do happen by undocumented immigrants in the United States? Yes, it has happened, but those rates tend to be actually quite a bit lower than the native-born population. So that may determine how you look at this bill and the necessity of whether this bill is really a crime bill or whether it's really trying to just take a stronger stance on immigration for other reasons.
Again, thanks for that call. And let's go next to Todd in Green Bay. Todd, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I was wondering, one of the duties of the federal government, as far as I thought the Constitution laid out, was to protect our borders and to, you know, protect the citizenry from foreign invasion, I guess you'd call it. And I'm wondering about the state's rights as compared to federal rights in that regard. And the other thing is that if I were in the country illegally and I had committed a crime, the first place I would go would be a sanctuary city. I would look and seek that out. What I'm wondering is that do city councils and county boards, et cetera, really have the right to just declare themselves a sanctuary city without taking this to a referendum of the voters in the city? Because a lot of people might feel that they're less safe because they could be harboring criminals within their borders. Mm-hmm. Because they are a sanctuary city.
Todd, interesting questions there. Thank you for that. And Paul, what do you think about that? We've got about a minute left for your answer.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot there. And one thing, when it comes to the crime aspect, many of the so-called sanctuary cities, including Madison, for instance, have said, hey, you know, we're going to cooperate with federal law enforcement when it comes to detaining people for possible deportation who have been arrested for serious crimes, like, you know, robbery, murder, those sorts of things. So that's one part of it, is depending on how you define sanctuary city, it may not apply to, you know, those immigrants who actually have committed more serious crimes. Going back to that point that I mentioned before, one part of the constitutional structure is that the federal government, in fact, does have primary responsibility over immigration enforcement, but it also, there are some limits in terms of what they can force localities to do.
And we have to leave it there. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Paul Nolet, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, with us to talk about so-called sanctuary cities.
In 2011, African-American youths in Dane County were 15 times more likely to spend time in jail than white youth. And once kids get into the system, that can lead to challenges that ripple throughout their lives. As Bridget Bowden reports, one program in Madison is aiming to curb those numbers by introducing kids to art.
Find a spot, and I will...
Making Justice is an art program for kids who've had contact with the justice system. It's run by Madison Public Library, where Jesse View is a teen services librarian.
By definition, teenagers are at risk. And so all teenagers in my philosophy are at risk because, we, you know, that's when you take chances, and we all did.
Making Justice started in 2013 and now serves about 500 kids each year. The goal is to provide a platform for them to express themselves, learn new skills, and meet potential mentors. Kids across the county participate in the program, including those in the Dane County Juvenile Detention Center.
The most basic outcome is to have tried something new, and know whether or not you like it based on experience and not just word of mouth or reading about it or, you know, making assumptions.
Today's group meets once a week, and the kids were referred to Making Justice by the court. At the end of the program, they'll put on an art show. Surprise is a high school junior. She says she's tried a lot of new things in the class.
Working with people and get you to learn stuff you didn't think it was possible to learn, like art. I hate art. And when you bring art in me, it won't work. But I did it. So, yeah.
And in this class, pizza is considered art.
Art to me can be gardening, it can be cooking, painting, screen printing. You know, it can be so many different things.
That's local artist Carlos Gacharna, one of the program's partners. He grew up in Madison and says he took some risks when he was younger.
Police officers, that kind of thing, could have sent me down a different path, but decided not to.
He says he could have easily been in the same situation as the kids in the program, but he got lucky.
So what I'm hoping to do is kind of like, so many of the kids that I see are on the edge. So if I can just pull them back before they get into one of those situations where you might not get lucky, then, you know, hopefully I did a good job.
In addition to making pizza, the kids get a lesson about anthropology. They learn that food is one of the best ways to learn about other cultures. Gacharna says he tries to make the classes about more than just what they're making.
To me, art is a vehicle to teach about a whole bunch of stuff. So I get to teach about culture, I get to teach about science, I get to teach about history, about elements of design. So in a sense, it's a vehicle to teach about, you know, about expanding learning in general.
Gacharna and the other partners have a great rapport with the kids. They play the music they like. They make jokes. You might even say they're cool. When sixth grader Tremaine's pizza collapses on its way to the oven, Gacharna helps him fix it.
We had a pizza turn calzone back into a pizza.
I'm kind of angry and happy at the same time. Now I created a new thing.
For Gacharna, Making Justice is about more than just the skills they're teaching.
I feel like we're on the front lines of dismantling the school-to-prison pipeline.
He says art and good mentors were what made the difference for him, and he hopes it's the same for the kids in the program. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, we'll find out about an energy rule under consideration that could raise prices of coal and nuclear fuel.
Movies and popcorn are a natural combo, but our guest says don't stop with the popcorn. It's just the beginning. We'll talk to the author of Eat What You Watch, a cookbook for movie lovers.
And for the WPR Centennial, we look back at the history of Wisconsin Public Radio.
And it's our weekly roundup of the top stories in state news. That's all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time.